sure we're running here, Lord. Okay, we're on.
The little wheels going around.
The little wheels are going around. Visiting with Ward Shanahan, a longtime lobbyist and insider in Montana politics, in the state capitol in Helena and around the legislature. Ward, it's great to have the opportunity to interview you. And maybe I could just ask you first, what was the legislature like? How would you describe the legislature when you first experienced it?
Well, I'm just trying to think. I get the actual first session that I got into was the 1961 session, and I was lobbying for the Railroad Association, Montana Railroad Association, which was made up of, at that time, the Northern Pacific, Great Northern, and Milwaukee, and the Union Pacific, and then we had the Butte, Anaconda, and Pacific, and some other little stub railroads like that. But
about what session would that have been?
That was 61. That's
61.
Yeah, I started with Ty Robinson and John Willard and that crew, and I was the Great Northern person in that group. This firm represented the Great Northern for probably 75 years, something like that.
Who did you replace?
I replaced my partner who was eager to get out, Newell Goff.
Okay, all right.
He was still on the board of the Railroad Association, but going up to the legislature made Newell nervous, so he immediately thrust me into the fray.
And that, of course, was during the period when the 1889 Constitution was in effect.
Yes.
And you've lobbied the legislature extensively prior to the 1972 Constitution and since the 1972
yes,
Constitution.
Yes, that's right.
So I'm interested in your impressions of the early years in the 60s when you lobbied, and you know, maybe your impressions of how what you did may have been affected by the 72 Constitution.
Well, I was a little more involved in that than you might think, as the legislature back at that time was pretty much a cowboy boot affair, really. The Stock Growers Association had an awful lot of input and taw, as they used to call it. And
what does taw mean?
Taw just means political influence.
Okay.
And main battles that I was involved in, of course, were usually between the railroads and the unions, and it wasn't really the Great Northern's unions. It was the unions fighting with the Milwaukee. The Milwaukee was financially strapped at that time, and they were not doing things that they should do to maintain health and safety for the workers, and the unions were raising hell about that most of the time. But there was an awful lot of old boy network stuff going on, you know, groups of people who all knew each other, as they do in Montana. You know, everybody was friends or related to everybody else in Montana. And
so a lot of networking took place.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of that, and the water holes were still going at that time.
I got here as a legislator just after the watering holes.
Yeah. Well, John Lahr, if you remember John Lahr, who was with the Montana, John was lobbying with the Railroad Association at that time, and John and I drew the short straws to run the water hole for the Railroad Association up in the Placer Hotel, and that was a real physical exertion because the drunks always stayed on, and you were there until quitting time, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you had to see that people got home and that nothing untoward happened. And the Anaconda Company was up on the sixth floor of the Placer. They were in the same end of the building. I think we were on the fourth, as I recall.
Somebody told me once, I think, that there was a sort of an unwritten rule that women legislators and women weren't welcome and perhaps the Anaconda Company watering hole?
That might have been the case for the Anaconda Company. I have specific recollection of women being in the railroad lobby water hole. The as I recall, there were several what do they call it, cosmetologists, lobbyists up there a good deal of the time. And, but Laura and I were sick and tired of that job after a very short time.
And so what would happen, just so I understand, at the end of the day, probably at the end of the legislative day, I suppose late in the afternoon or early in the evening, you'd open up this large room or suite of rooms at the Placer Hotel.
Yes.
And you'd have what, cold cuts and cocktails and that
sandwiches
sort of
and cocktails and beer and that kind of stuff, yeah.
And you'd have comfortable furniture and the legislators,
yeah,
and other lobbyists presumably too?
Oh yeah, they'd come in, sit down, talk.
Kind of drift in and sit,
yeah,
down and talk. And was there lobbying that took place or?
Oh yeah, there were. The railroads normally got, you know, we didn't get the Butte crowd, which was usually in the Anaconda room, but we had a lot of the agricultural crowd because they had an interest in rail rates and all that kind of stuff, and they always wanted to express their opinion on that. And so that was a general run of the thing. There were a lot of gin mills down on the main street of Helena at that time, and there were a group that would spend their time down there in and out of the bars, and there were fist fights that took place in the middle of the main street of Helena between legislators.
What, do you remember that? I mean, a specific incident?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That would have been, what, like in the 50s or 60s?
I was in the 60 to 63 session along in there, yeah.
Do you remember any of the specifics of who the legislators might have been?
Well, I remember their names. I'm not sure I want to memorialize them forever. But
it was probably in the newspaper, I imagine.
Yeah, it was. I think it was covered in the newspaper. Altercation took place outside the bank club, which is right below our window.
Uh-huh.
And so it was hard to avoid looking out and seeing it. But, you know, that kind of thing.
That happened during the day, then. It didn't happen at night?
Well, it happened at night, yeah. It was later at night. But, you know, as I say, we were up there all hours.
A Democrat and a Republican?
Well, I think, there were Democrats and Republicans in the argument, but I think the basic fight that I recall was between a couple of Republicans. And,
Well, you can say, can't you?
I'm trying to remember. I think Ben Stein, who was a rancher from down in central Montana, was one of them. And then I think one of the ringlings was in there in that deal, because he was in the legislature.
Paul Ringling. Yeah.
And it was you were attracted to the window because of the loud voices coming from the street below.
Well, I remember Ben Stein, Ward. I didn't serve in the legislature with him, but I think he started out as a Democrat and then switched parties and became a Republican.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was a colorful individual. He was from back east someplace.
Well, and he was an author and a historian, and he may have been writing some articles at that time that did not sit well with Mr. Ringling's family history.
Well, I remember Paul Ringling. I think he might have been a Democrat legislator. And he was, wasn't he related to the Circus family?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My father used to work for Ring Brothers as a wrangler when he was at the Montana State back in the 20s. So I was fairly familiar with, you know, discussing that whole situation with my dad. And I got to know Paul pretty well.
Well, he had a son or a grandson who was here as a lobbyist, and I knew him a little bit, Rock Ringling.
Yeah, he runs a bed and breakfast, I think,
okay,
here in Helena, yeah.
And I know him a little,
yeah,
bit. Is there in your experience, Ward, is there a legislator, or is there a lobbyist, maybe more than one lobbyist, but at least a lobbyist that kind of stands out in your mind as for any important reason? Maybe you've got more than one.
Well, there are probably more than one, but Bill Kirkpatrick was the chief lobbyist for the Anaconda Company at that time. He was the Western General Counsel for the Anaconda Company, and he was always on the scene. And the Anaconda Company had about six or seven lobbyists circulating around the floor. They were omnipresent, you know. And we had about four of us, I guess, always on the floor.
Did you work with the Anaconda Company lobbyists?
We didn't necessarily work with them. We were kind of sitting in the same committees because they were usually committees that had to do with business and industry and that kind of stuff, with taxation. And I think we were definitely friendly with them.
Yeah. I knew Bill Kirkpatrick too. He was after pretty much out when the Anaconda Company was in deep decline, and I think he may have represented one of the mills, one of the plywood, part of what had been the old Anaconda Company timber holdings,
mm-hmm.
Smurfit Stone or Horner Waldorf or whatever that was. I knew him a little bit that way, and he knew I was interested in politics and history, and I had a couple of interesting conversations with him, and he told me that he was the Western General Counsel.
Yeah.
Why does he stand out in your mind?
Well, he was just a very genial and intelligent fellow, and nothing ever seemed to ruffle his feathers very much. He just kind of walked around the lobby as an older brother kind of personality, and very friendly, and he was helpful to people like Laura and I, who were just starting out in the business of lobbying. And I'm trying to think, well, Dan Regan's father was up there.
Who was Dan Regan?
He was a vice president of Montana Power Company.
I see. And his father was
involved? And then you
had... For the Anaconda Company or Montana Power?
Well, I'm just trying to think. Whether he was lobbying for Montana Power or for the Anaconda. It seems to me he was arguing or lobbying for Anaconda, but Len Regan. And,
Leonard Regan.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And I have to think a bit about it. Then we had a fellow that was attached to the Historical Society for so many years.
Boo McGilvery?
Boo McGilvery. I mean, there were some real characters around there. The Boo McGilvery was a guy that just wallowed in the glow of his own personality, you know. And he, I can remember one incident when we were sitting in the balcony of, you didn't have the machines at that time, so.
Voting machines.
Yeah, and we didn't have any, we had to sit. And we didn't have all this rapid paper coming out that you do today. So we had to sit with a notebook up in the balcony and listen to what the clerk said about bills that were introduced and what committees they were assigned to and so forth. And so Laura and I would do that dutifully every day. One of us take the House, the other take the Senate. And when they went in session, we wrote all that stuff down and gave the sponsor and the subject matter of the bill and where it was assigned. And but then they go, off the record and out of the journal. What was that? Order of business number 9 or 10 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And some guy got up to introduce the county commissioners of Silverbow County as guests at the legislature. And there was a kind of a pause after the guy had said their names, and these guys stood up in the balcony of the House, and the Boo McGilvery, who had a very deep, melodious voice, said in his usual barely concealed whisper, three more likely looking burglars never poured soup in a safe. And it just tore the place up. I mean, they just... He was a stand-up comedian, you know. He just had that ability to, he had that timing, and the whole place just erupted in laughter.
He was a Montana Power Company lobbyist.
I think so, but he actually lobbied He may have been lobbying for the power company. I don't know at the time. He was lobbying for the Innkeepers Association. He was famous for what was known as the Bedbug Bill, which is a bill he would put in to make sure that he was employed for that session, to require that all inns have certified mattresses, you know, that were bedbug free and so forth like that. And then he could come in and fight it. See.
And that would
justify his existence.
Did he ever tell you the baking powder biscuit story?
What was that? No.
The baking powder biscuit story?
I think I'm familiar with that. Go ahead.
Well, Bill Kirkpatrick introduced me to Boo McGill Book.
Yeah.
And he said, ask Boo to tell you the baking powder biscuit story. And I don't want to take too much of our time here, but it's a great story. Boo came to Montana from Baraboo, Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
And that's how he got his nickname, Boo. And he was in his late teens, I think, and he went to work for a cattle company over in the Little Rockies, near mm-hmm. Havre. And he said he was out just a greenhorn teenage cowboy finding strays in the spring or fall or
yeah.
something or other, and he got lost in the mountains. And he became frightened, he got cold, he got wet, it was raining, and he was been lost for a couple of days, and he came across this rude dugout shelter in the side of a hill. And it was obviously inhabited, and he went inside, and there was a stove, so he built a fire, and in the dim light of the dugout, he found some flour, and he put some flour and some water in a skillet, and it was this baking powder can on the shelf, one of those old red Calumet, and he put some baking powder in, and stirred it all up, and heated it up, and it was something warm for him to eat. He said it was gritty, and it, you know, didn't rise very well, and that sort of thing, but it really tasted good to him, and he was just getting warm, and he had a full tummy, and this person came through the door who owned this dugout.
Yeah.
And it was a very old Indian man.
Yeah.
And the old Indian man said, that's okay, you obviously were in trouble. And he said, I don't, you know, it's fine that you had a meal and that sort of thing. So he said they got to talking for a few minutes. And he said the old man told him that he'd been more or less a hermit in that area for several decades, and that his family had died in the Wounded Knee Massacre over in South Dakota.
Oh, for God's sake.
And he said, I've lived here ever since. I've been pretty depressed, and I've been kind of a hermit. And he said that Wounded Knee Massacre, as you may know, occurred in the winter, and the ground was frozen, and we weren't able to bury the people who were killed there. So he said, we cremated a fair number of them. And he said, in fact, that's the ashes of my mother and father in that baking powder biscuit cake. And Boo just ate them. So.
Oh, good Lord. Oh, dear. Well, that sounds like him. He had a lot of anecdotes connected with him. Great, great, interesting character. But there were a number of others, I'm just trying to think. I mean, Crippen, who was, of course,
Lloyd Crippen.
Lloyd Crippen,
who was lobbied for the Anaconda
yeah.
Company.
Yeah, and I became quite a good friend of his. I think he was a great guy. And
I'm going to be interviewing him later, incidentally.
Or
yeah.
Yeah, they were kind of like the older brothers in a fraternity house, you know.
Yeah.
That's the way it was. And Laura and I just kind of figured we'd stick around and keep our mouths shut and our ears open, you know, and learn who these people were in the legislature and how to judge their reactions, what their true feelings were, and that's what you do as a lobbyist. You try to look at the personalities of the people you're dealing with. You know the ones that you can trust and who trust you, and you know the ones you can't trust.
Yeah.
There are some people who, of course, the idea of a lobbyist is conjures up all kinds of bad dreams in their minds, and they can't even have a civil conversation with. But most of the people are pretty open and
are there approach. Now you have experience that spans, I think, anyway, four decades of working with the legislature and legislators. Are there a legislator or two or three that particularly stand out in your mind for whatever reason during that period of time?
Lordy.
There'd be many, I know, but
Well, I'm trying to think of
Bardno?
Francis Bardno, who I found to be a real gentleman and an easy guy to talk to. Even with his speech impediment, it was he was pretty down to earth kind of guy. And it was a pleasure to meet people like that, because you had, it gave you some anchors, you know. Things kind of settled down when you knew where you could go. These lighthouses were around, you know, that you could expect to turn on the light every once in a while.
Did you have a particular experience with Francis that's especially memorable?
Yeah, I do have one, and this was back, because I was on the Historical Society board, you know, for a number of years, and I was a trustee for quite a long time, for about 12 years, I guess, and then I became president of the Historical Society. But Montana State had, of course, gotten itself involved with the Museum of the Rockies, and they had come in and gotten themselves an appropriation of $300,000 to put the Museum of the Rockies on the Bozeman campus. And it happened in the same session that they cut the budget of the Montana Historical Society. So I was up there lobbying with Mr. Cockhill, who was the...
Brian Cockhill,
who was the director of the Historical Society, trying to head off a second run at the legislature on behalf of the Museum of the Rockies, because... And I went to talk to Francis, and he said, and I can't remember the name of the fellow that was president of the university, or Montana State University at the time, but he had been in Colorado and then came up.
Bill Keats, I think.
Keats, yeah. And you know how Francis was with that speech impediment. When he got excited, why, he kind of blew air out of the side of his mouth, and he says, "That damn Keats, I told him not to come back here again." And when I got that indication of the way he felt about that, why, we were well on our way to heading off another run at the money that should have been given to the Montana Historical Society. And of course, there's, you know, as agencies go, why, there's people that hate them and people that love them up there. And the Historical Society takes quite a battering from legislature. They use it as a kind of a political football, and it depends on whose side you're on, you know. Montana's a place, as you know, where there isn't enough to go around.
Right.
So people spend their time fighting over, you know, a little pie.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get your slice and sometimes you don't. And that's just the way it is.
What's the old saying? When the manger is empty, the horses bite each other.
Yeah, that's right.
We've been through a lot of that in our state. And
you'll see that happening. And there's always a conspiracy theorist around on one side or the other to characterize the situation as the result of the bad actions of some subterranean force, you know. The fact is, we just happen to live in a place that doesn't produce a lot of money, and then in the last few years, and you're getting my personal stump speech at this time, we've done a lot to make sure that that doesn't get any better.
Yeah, right.
You know, we've gotten rid of any increase in coal mining. We've gotten rid of any increase in oil and gas production, and we've cut down the timber harvest on the national forest by about 80%, so... that all seems to be a happy thing from one's point of view, and on the other hand, they don't seem to make a connection that if we don't have enough money for education, somehow, why did this happen? Well, it's that subterranean force again that caused this bad thing to happen. Not the enlightened view of the people who stopped all this. Incredible. But there's very little logic in politics.
Any other legislator pops in your mind?
Oh, God, I'm just trying to. I have a funny incident, and you might ask Willard about this. We're going
to
talk to John.
I'll talk to him tomorrow.
There was an old fellow by the name of Oscar Belgord, who was a senator from down at La Vina. And Oscar was in his 80s, I believe, at the time he was in the Senate. And he used to sit in the front row. And this is when the voting machines first came in. And what's his name? There's a guy that was in charge of the voting machines. And was, he wrote the book, I Knew Them All.
Walter Marshall.
Walter Marshall.
He was the Secretary of the Senate.
He was Secretary of the Senate, and he was running the voting machine. And we had a bill coming up in the Senate, and we knew it was going to be close. So Laura and I are sitting in the balcony of the Senate, and of course, John comes in, John Willard, to look over the situation, and here's Oscar Belgord, who's fallen asleep in the front row. And he was one of our expected votes, you see. Well, they call for the vote, and the lights start coming on, and John leans out of the balcony of the Senate and says to Belgord down on the floor, Oscar, for Christ's sake, wake up! Belgord wakes up kind of startled and pushes the wrong button, and we lose the bill by one vote.
Oh no! Sleeping at the switch.
Well, it was really funny. But Oscar, a very genial fellow, and I got to know him pretty well. I remember him quite well. There undoubtedly there will be a number of others come to mind. You work with them all.
Sure.
And you're working with the one that's most important at the time you're working on a particular subject. And so it's not a good idea to get too familiar with certain people because it breeds contempt.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And so you have to, you know, give them their space. And so I guess that's... I seem to be able to work with Democrats as well as Republicans most of the time, and had to because the Democrats were in control a good deal of the time, back at that time.
Is that thing on?
It's an automatic machine. It clicks itself on.
You might want to just kind of speak up a little bit.
Yeah, I'll try to. I'll try to get closer to the microphone.
Might be a little bit of a problem for you. let me just mention two or three names. Frank Hazelbaker.
Oh yeah, I knew Frank Hazelbaker. He was kind of the dean of the Senate, I think.
He was a senator and representative from Beaverhead County,
yes,
from Dillon,
yeah.
For a fair number of years. Jim Felt.
Yeah, Jim Felt I knew also very well.
Speaker of the House from Billings.
Yeah.
Any stories, any thoughts, or anything come to mind about either of those?
Well, sometimes you wanted to stay out of the way of the people that are leaving the most wake. In other words, there were those lobbyists who were always very close to the leadership and following them around and expecting to get results from them and so forth. We didn't do that as a general practice because you always got in a position where you're putting these people in an embarrassing situation and it was forcing them into, and a lot of lobbies didn't. Force people into a public spectacle of some kind, and we realized that their political capital depended on them being able to get votes, and we didn't want to embarrass them.
Sure.
But there were other lobbies that didn't feel that way. They used them to the full extent they could, and we tried to move it around and mix it up all the time. We had a few people that we figured were not. I don't like the word in your pocket, but that we could count on.
That were generally going to be your allies.
Yeah, they were going to be on our side. And we could count on them to bring us inside information from what was going on in the caucuses and that sort of thing. And so we didn't have to use a heavy hand in doing that. And a particularly good person at that was Ty Robinson, who was a very soft-spoken fellow who got a lot done, I think.
And Ty was a very effective lobbyist for the railroads?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And probably as well known as anybody, as well as John Willard. You know, worked together. And
were you ever involved in helping legislators draft bills? Because I've heard Ty Robinson assisted with that sometimes.
Yeah, we wrote a lot of bills right here in the office. And the power company had a lobby in the back. My wife was a stenographer for the power company lobby for a year or two, and they would draw the legislation right in the office of the lobby, and then get the bill in. You know, it would be introduced right in the form that the lobby wrote it, using the rule book as it existed. When the legislative council came in, of course, that all changed. But the lobbies were pretty well involved, and they'd have the bills pre-drafted and ready to be introduced, and just hand them to the sponsor and put them in.
This was before the Legislative Services Division.
Before the Legislative Council came along.
Then legislators were responsible for getting their own bills drafted.
That's right.
And they could have an attorney or some knowledgeable person in their community do it, but they were better off to have someone with some experience do it, such as
knew what the rules were, so they could get it in the right form, and it had to have certain introductory paragraphs, and the heading had to be a certain way, and
you knew how to do that.
Yeah,
Ty Robinson knew how to do that.
Right. Yeah, right. And so we did a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. A couple more names. I'm just going to mention them and see if they trigger any story or any thought. John Hall, Representative John Hall from Great Falls.
Yes, knew John pretty well. He was a very serious fellow. In fact, I think he wound up in a state of depression because he was you know, always worrying about things and took things very seriously. And I can't recall what happened to him, but he did have some serious thing happen because of that depression. Whether he committed suicide.
Yeah, I think he died young anyway.
Yes.
I remember that.
And it was...
I served in the House.
A very decent chap, I thought.
He seemed to be very ethical and highly intelligent, an attorney, very intellectual, but kind of distant.
Well, and
he was minority floor leader one session, I remember.
Yeah, and the you know, if you got yourself, and I had a tendency to do the same thing, I guess, to a certain extent, if you got in a state of mind where you took this stuff too seriously, it would really get you down because you'd feel that you know, the world had come to an end because you were focused in on this thing so much that it was a real disappointment when you lost. But you couldn't hold that view very long because the same guy that voted against you to kill your bill was going to turn around and vote for you to pass the next one.
You probably had a fair amount of contact with Representative Joe Brand.
Oh, yeah. That gives rise to a couple of, because he was part of the union organization.
Representative from Deer Lodge.
Yeah.
And a railroad labor union member.
Oh, yeah. And of course, the railroad labor unions had about 7 or 8 lobbyists up there also. And the Butte bunch got into an argument with them over something, and I don't recall what it was in particular one time, and Quillacy, I think, was in the
Representative Joe Quillacy.
Joe Quillacy, yeah. And I was walking through the lobby, and at that time you didn't have any of this restriction that you have today where you can hardly move away from the geedunk stand out in front there, you know. You can't get into the lobby and of the house, but they got into a personal beef with one of the union lobbyists, and Quillacy saw me through the door and comes running out in the hall and says, "We're going to give you one, Shan. Let me know which one you want." And I went up and checked with my group, and we gave them the number of a bill, and by God, we got, I think it was 6 or 8 votes at that time. We got a straight vote in our favor on that bill the next time it came up. And that was I was really amazed at that performance.
So the votes came primarily from the Butte Anaconda legislature?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but apparently Joe Brand didn't know that they had done that.
I think that's right.
So,
because Joe was the main defender on the floor.
Yeah.
But somebody had double-crossed somebody on some deal, and so they were going to get back at him and let him know that they were giving it to him. And there was this kind of game going on all the time. There was a lot of fun sometimes about this sort of thing. You had to have it because it otherwise you'd go nuts. Place.
Do you remember the mock sessions?
Yes.
Now there were a couple, I guess, that occurred after I got there, but I think they were more common in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
Can you describe any of those?
Well, you know, Jerry Anderson seemed to be the major domo for those things. He really enjoyed those things.
And he was, of course, a legislator from Yellowstone County in the 50s and early 60s, and then later became a lobbyist.
That's right. And he stage managed the entire in his view, I think. But he stage managed the whole legislature. He made sure that the pages got tips, and he made sure that the pages were taken out to lunch, and he just kind of was the social chairman of the whole deal, and so he ran that mock session.
And what he'd do is the mock session was, some of the lobbyists were actors and they played the parts of different legislators.
Yeah, that's right.
Tried to reenact
and made fun of them.
Funny situations that occurred during the session.
That's right.
And do you think that contributed maybe to a degree of camaraderie in the?
Yeah, I think it did. It kept the thing light. It got rid of some of the bitterness.
Any thoughts on term limitations?
At that time, well, I don't. You know,
term limitations didn't exist then. When you started out.
My personal view on term limits is, it's 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. I figure it's you have to keep churning the population for new people, and maybe the term limit, maybe it's too short. Maybe it should be 12 years instead of 8. But I don't necessarily see it as a bad thing. The general objection is that term limits get rid of the race memory you have up there of the people that know what the rules are and know how to get things done. And I think that's true to a certain extent. As you know, there's a lot of old hands that are needed to kind of calm things down.
And you have long-term personal friendships that I think develop. Because I can just say my own case that I came to know Mike Halligan, Lawrence Grossfield, Bruce Crippen, Joe Missouri, very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think sometimes those old longtime friendships can be important.
And people on both sides of the aisle who trust each other, that will grease the skids for stuff to get done. Mm-hmm. And we've gotten a lot more ideological in the last few years.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think it's probably mass media to a great extent. They tend to crystallize a lot of this stuff, and it's got to be an either-or proposition. And frankly, either-or is rarely what the legislature does. As you know, compromise is the rule that pushes things through. And, you know, sometimes you have to try a bill 2-3 times before you get it right. You put a piece of a bill in, and the next legislative session you put in another piece of it, and finally in the next session you get the whole thing done. And because people are very conservative generally, regardless whether they're Republicans or Democrats, they don't want to try something unless they work it out first.
Yeah.
And I think that makes sense. That's what makes a jury a good thing. You get a cross-section of humanity there that taking a fresh look at something. You know.
Ward, how would you characterize the legislature in the 1960s, and how would you compare it to the legislature that you knew, say, in the 1990s?
Well, I think the gradual workload for the people in later years has increased. As I'm sure you're aware, the amount of paper flowing through that place, it really gets burdensome for these people, and I think they give it a really good college try to get the work done right, and they're serious about it. But that takes a lot of the fun out of it. It takes a lot of the hijinks and games and things like that out of it. And time to mess around, like getting drunk at night, you know, and then having to show up the next day. I mean, you just can't afford physically to do that.
Yeah. Whereas there was probably more hospitality kind of things.
Yeah.
Well,
the water holes and that sort of thing. And then, of course, the Puritans among us came on and attacked the water hole system as the work of the devil, you know.
Is that what happened?
Oh, yes.
Because I arrived in 1971, and I think the watering holes basically closed down in the 67 and 69 sessions.
Yeah.
Right in there. And
See, 71 is when political correctness was beginning to set in.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the new Constitution was about to pass.
Yeah.
And stuff. All of this sweetness and light was about to occur, so you had to have a good foil, and of course industry has always been the foil in Montana, so we got the blame for corrupting all these bucolic Puritans from out there who came to town with a clean shave and a bath and got soiled with the
Well, when we think about the industry and the jobs that were provided and the economy of Montana, you touched on this a little bit, is different now than it was, you know.
Sure.
And of course the Anaconda Company was kind of the keystone to the business and industry group in Montana.
Yeah, there are those these days that would actually own up to the fact that maybe the Anaconda Company wasn't such a bad thing.
Can you comment a little bit about that? I mean, how you kind of see that? How?
Well, the early days of the Anaconda Company never left it. It was some of the things that were done at that time tended to set the population's teeth on edge. There's a book called Smoke Wars. It's out about the battle between the Anaconda Company and those ranchers and farmers down in the Deer Lodge Valley.
Yeah.
Well, the first president of the Anaconda Company was in our law firm.
Who was that?
William Scallon.
Okay.
And he had been the law partner of Senator Walsh. And when Walsh went to the Senate, why Scallon came over here. And we still have Scallon's and Walsh's conference tables here in our office today.
Huh.
And but he had left the Anaconda Company with a bad taste in his mouth. He had done a lot to fight Heinze. He was really the person, I think, that should be given credit to winning the War of the Copper Kings, because he got the legislature to pass those laws that allowed you to disqualify judges, which broke Heinze's control over the judiciary in Silverville County. But he had had some words with Con Kelly, and I think disagreed with the way the Anaconda County was going, but in those days, corporate control and corporate objectives were a lot more arbitrary than they are today, and the decisions on that were being made back in New York. They weren't being made here. I still have the Standard Oil Company file in my basement. I've given a copy to the Historical Society, but it's Scallon's file of the case, and it's just a different era, and of course there was less regard for the safety of the worker and safety of the general population, because we had to get this thing going and had to get her done, you know, to get this stuff out of the ground, and of course the forces that be in the East were requiring that be done. The whole telecommunications and electric business of the United States is based upon copper wire.
Right.
And there was a hell of a demand for that.
Right.
And so the urgency of that whole situation just, and the wages that were being paid actually were pretty good compared to wages other places. And
so Montana had a high per capita income.
Yes.
And a lot of good employment opportunities.
Sure it did.
During the last session when the Anaconda Company was in its heyday.
But it was pretty well safety be damned, you know.
Yeah.
For that sort of thing. And
do you think the Anaconda Company fought efforts to make, to try to get greater worker safety and better working conditions and that sort of thing?
Well, their argument, if you read that book, The Smoke Wars, their argument, and they're quoting him right out of the newspaper in there, was, well, if they can figure a way to make it profitable. For example, the Cottrell precipitators on the Anaconda smelter, that was that's the thing that took the arsenic out of the smoke as it went up the stack, an electric precipitator. Well, they figured out that if they put those Cottrell precipitators in, that it would, they could sell the arsenic. And according to my information, 90% of the Paris green they use for ant poison came out of the Anaconda smokestack.
Huh.
In North America. Huh. It was almost the sole source. And but they refused to budge if they couldn't find a way to make it profitable.
I see.
The hell with the livestock and the crops and the Dirlage Valley otherwise.
Well, when you think about them, you know, Bill Kirkpatrick and I were friends, and I had, as I mentioned to you, you and I had that in common, and we both had interesting conversations with him. And he, in one of my conversations, characterized the Anaconda Company as a kind of a benign, sort of controlling uncle figure in the state of Montana.
Yeah.
I remember he said to me that the Anaconda Company took care of its own interests tenaciously in the legislature and otherwise in the state, and even before Congress. But at the same time, he said we wanted a good state.
Well,
so he said we tried to make sure that Montana was a well-managed and good state.
And there wasn't an awareness of what they were doing wrong, you know, to a certain extent. And they weren't, these issues that later came up as what we now know as political correctness and so forth, those weren't in anybody's mind, you know. The average miner who was out digging in the hillside was doing the same thing they were at a smaller scale. You know?
But what I hear you saying too, though, Gord, is that if creating better working conditions would cost the company money, then they probably would protect their money before they'd in an enlightened.
That's correct.
Way. Yeah.
Yeah, I think history bears that out. And I don't think they're alone in this. In fact, the historian over at the University of Montana, I'm trying to remember his name again.
Harry Fritz?
No, came out of Denver.
Yemens?
What? Yemens, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he writes a good piece on this. He says, you know, this Anaconda Company wasn't unique. Every mining company in Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, and Arizona was doing the same thing. And it was just the way things were done. And it was kind of a mortal sin to try to stop workmen from being employed. You know?
Sure,
and
yeah.
And they kept using that argument, and except that people were breathing all kinds of bad things. And
silicosis.
Yeah,
that
all
was
that
an issue
kind of
still
stuff.
Well,
it's a real
situation.
Problem.
Yeah.
And there were injuries. Mining has a high rate of serious injuries. Just because of the nature of the work.
Any thought on their ownership of the newspapers?
Well, you're asking, well, I can give you a recollection of it. This office was the home office of the company that owned the newspapers for the Anaconda Company, the Fairmont Corporation.
The Fairmont Corporation was a subsidiary of the Anaconda Company?
Yes, it was.
And it owned the newspapers in Montana.
Yeah, and T.B. Weir was the president of the Fairmont.
And right. T.B. Weir was a partner of Scallon in this law.
Yes, yeah. And it definitely had a dampening effect on certain certain news articles, all right. But they essentially ran the company papers out of here for quite a while.
And so, of course, that was somewhat before. They sold their papers in 1959.
Yeah.
So that was a little before your involvement.
I came in here in 58, so that was happening right at the time. They were probating Scallon's estate when I came in here. And that's how I wound up with Scallon's file on the Standard Oil case. Was Dorothy O'Brien, his old secretary, came in and said, "Mr. Scallon would have liked you to have this," and gave me this thing. And it's got some neat handbills in it about, you know, the fights with Heinze and stuff like that. So it's quite a collection of stuff.
Remember you you shared with me the note from Theodore Roosevelt to George Goza.
Yeah.
About
yeah, it's hanging on the wall right there.
Oh yeah. What a wonderful thing that was.
Well, and of course the Wellington Rankins, he started out in this firm with Weir in 1907, and then he eloped with the boss's daughter, and so that meant his departure from the firm.
Oh, Rankin eloped with the boss's daughter?
Yeah.
With
and
Weir's daughter?
In those days, with Will Wallace, who was
I see.
And he was the senior person in the firm at that
time. So Wallace's daughter was Rankin's first wife?
That's right.
Okay.
And of course, in those days, parents could get a daughter marriage annulled if she was under the age of 18 years. And they proceeded to do that. They annulled the marriage because she had to have your parents' consent.
I see.
Yeah, a woman did at that time. And so Rankin left the firm, and of course, it's this was kind of a rock-ribbed Republican firm at the time, why Rankin became the great backer of Theodore Roosevelt. And so that's how that all really happened, I think, from what I know of. Talking to Weir about it, and Weir told me the story about the elopement and the annulment and all that stuff.
Now, I think I knew that Rankin had been married once before, when he was a young man, and then he
that's
was
right.
a bachelor for a long time. Until
he was a Christian Scientist, and he had stayed in the house that he had bought for them and prayed for 30 days, and she didn't return, and so he sold the house and never married again until he met Louise later on. And I think Louise impressed him because she convicted his client of murder, I think, over in Lewistown. She was one of Montana's first woman lawyers.
Yeah.
And I've known them quite well because he was, of course, a Republican Party National Committee man for a long time.
You did know Wellington Rankin quite
yes.
well?
I tried a couple of cases against him.
Yeah, no, Ward, I've always been fascinated by him because I was interested in politics. I have been since I was a kid. And he was a very prominent figure. I think he died sometime in the middle 1960s.
Yeah.
But to my knowledge, even though I went to, I think my first Republican convention was 1964, but I don't recall, I've heard stories about him, but how would you describe him?
Well, he was a big man. He was taller than I am. Outweighed me 100 pounds, I think. Always wore a blue serge suit with a Homburg hat. And had been a professional wrestler.
Huh.
And I think he was Montana's first Rhodes Scholar. That's the information I have about him. And he was quite an impressive looking guy. And so people were afraid of him, you see. And he...
A big voice, big presence.
Yeah, big presence. And, you know, behave yourself, I'm going to break your neck. You know, that sort of thing. So he had a lot of self-confidence.
Did he have a sense of humor? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I thought he had a definite sense of humor. He always kind of chuckled about stuff and would pop a joke in the middle of some serious meeting, you know, to kind of lighten up things. Yeah, we were in an involved lawsuit trying to get it settled with about 11 lawyers in the thing. And we had about three or four meetings in a row and nothing was happening. He'd kind of say, "Well, ho, ho, ho." He says, "I think we ought to keep having these meetings." He knew nothing was happening.
So that was good for him. Huh?
Yeah. And but a very intelligent man. You know, just, he had the He had, as I remember, because George Bennett and I used to go up and sit in his office on election night. He had the exit poll thing figured out at that time, before the computer came along. And he would have people taking exit polls in Kalispell, Missoula, and Bozeman.
He'd have friends that would, what, go to the a polling place in Kalispell or Bozeman or Missoula and ask people how they voted on the way out?
Yeah, that's right. And he would, they would then call in their counts, you know, of how many people they talked to and everything like that. Because he'd given them, statistically, he knew what he was doing. And
this would have been clear back in the 50s?
Oh, yeah. This was, well, when I started in 58, he'd been doing this for some time. And I was the, at that time, became the congressional, Western District Congressional Committeeman for the Republican Party. And so I was interested in what was going on. And
George
said,
Bennett, who's another young lawyer.
Yeah, he was the local chairman of the Republican Party.
So you and George went to Wellington Rankin's office in 1958.
We'd sit there and listen to him pontificate while election returns are coming in, you know.
But he'd get a telephone call from the guy up in Kalispell before the polls had even closed.
Yeah, and so he'd sit there and do some figuring on his paper, and he said, well, you know, we need so many votes to offset the solid Democratic vote in Butte.
Yeah.
And so we got to come out of Missoula with a certain amount, we got to come out of Bozeman with a certain amount, we got to come out of Kalispell with a certain amount.
Sure.
Or we're not going to make it. And he'd know by 9:30 at night whether we're going to make it or not. Yeah. And he was an amazing fellow. I enjoyed visiting him.
You know, I've heard his office was kind of a, even though he was very wealthy and owned a huge amount of land, his office was a kind of a ramshackle kind of a place.
Yeah, and I'm not exactly sure why. I did talk to Judge Gid Bolt. I don't really know Judge Bolt, but Bolt was in the firm when Goza was in there. And
Goza was once in your law firm?
No. Goza was in Rankin's office.
Oh, okay.
And but Gid Bolt, who later became federal district judge over in Washington, and tried the case of the president of the Teamsters Union over there, as a matter of fact, Beck. He came to town one time, and he went up to Rankin's office to visit it. And what Rankin had done, they had a fire in the back of the building, and part of the building had burned out. Mm-hmm. And Rankin just left it that way, you know. And he used to keep one floor where they stacked hay for the ranch, and he had all these...
This was in an office building here in Helena?
Oh, yeah, it was the Pittsburgh block, right down where the big brick building in the center of Main Street is now down there.
And it was partially damaged by fire, and he had hay stacked in the back of it?
Well, in the back, one of the floors had hay in it, and he had all these ranch hands that were paroled convicts that he got paroled to his custody, and he had them working out on the ranch, and that's where they slept when they came to town. It was up in that hay up there on the fourth floor, I guess, of the building. And he had a Turkish guy ran the elevator. It was a cage elevator in the front of this thing. And I remember going in there the first time. You're supposed to have one of these safety certificates, you know, in the elevator, you know, saying that the state engineer had inspected this elevator. And then they put a new stamp with the date that happened. Well, this particular one, the state engineer that had signed this one was no longer alive, and the year that was involved had been erased with a pencil eraser, and a new date had been penciled in.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, it was a real menagerie to try to get in there. And
where did this Turkish guy come from?
Hmm? He was some guy that had been in the pen that. But he did the errand running for Rankin, but Bolt said that he had taken some files out of a drawer to prop open a door that was blown around in a storm back in 1939 or something, and he went up in that place 25 years later and the files were still sitting on the floor holding this door open.
Oh, gosh.
And so it was kind of an interesting exchange because there were a lot of lawyers passed through that firm. A lot of fairly prominent lawyers were actually in Rankin's tutelage for quite a while.
You know, Gene Turnage, when he was a young attorney, I think sometime probably in the early or middle 50s, described to me a visit once to Rankin's office, and it was, he said he feared for his life on that elevator. And I think he mentioned some elderly Oriental guy or something or other that operated the thing, and he didn't make Gene feel any more secure, and they got up to Rankin's office, and there was plaster falling out of the wall or the ceiling or something or other.
Well, I was standing there one day. I went in there, and here was Jeanette Rankin trying to get up the elevator. And there was a thing, a button, you know, one of these things you buy in the hardware store that said ring bell for service. And you push this thing, and you'd hear a bell ringing up three or four floors above. And she had pushed the bell a couple of times, and she pushed it again. Finally, this voice yells down the elevator shaft, "Use the effing stairs." And she looked at me and said, "Well, I suppose we'd better."
That was the Turkish guy?
Yeah. Yeah. And so she and I trudged on up to all five flights of stairs to the top floor. He had one set of rooms that were, he'd bought all of the cavalry harness and saddles and saddlebags from the army that had been out at Fort Harrison for a while. And he had one whole room full of that stuff. Huh. And he had a room full of Jeanette's campaign literature. I've got some of it down here.
Really? Yeah.
And I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I think I ought to give it to the historian.
Yeah. I collected a fair amount of political memorabilia, and I was Secretary of State and turned it over to the Historical Society.
Yeah.
I know they'd like it.
Yeah, that's just...
So he was a... he realized the historical significance of things and saved things.
Oh, yeah. So that was kind of the freewheeling attitude that I think that you had around here for a while. And, of course, then the college-trained professionals arrived. That's one of the excuse me, the shock factors that's happened in my lifetime. My class, I guess, was, we felt we were pretty well educated, and the problem that the state had with the Anaconda Company was that the Anaconda Company was a tough customer to deal with. And so the state didn't have a lot of enforcement authority under the old Constitution. And that brought on the need for the new Constitution, or so the backers felt. And to a certain extent it was true. The Anaconda Company was, well, in Governor Dixon's time, Anaconda Company was not paying net proceeds tax because it was always able to file a return that said that there were no net proceeds because the costs of extraction exceeded the value of the material extracted. And so Dixon came in with an excise, the metal mines tax, which got the state of Montana some revenue out. Huge deposit stuff over there. And the Anaconda Company probably went to work and defeated Governor Dixon, a Republican.
Right.
And who the Republican Party should be proud of for having done that. Later years when I did a lot of tax, state and local taxation work. And I was dealing with the Department of Revenue and the director of the Corporation Tax Division. I was using a statute of limitations on behalf of a client. State of Montana should do something within 10 years, you know, or they don't get the right to collect that. And he said, "Well, if the Anaconda Company thought as much of your statute of limitations offense, they would have used it." And I just settled a settlement. This is when they've been bought out by ARCO for $13 million in back taxes. And I said, who handled that case? And he gave me the name of the lawyer in L.A. It was in a, I think it was O'Melvin and Myers, which is a large law firm in L.A. And so I called the guy and I said, well, the Department of Revenue doesn't think much of my statute of limitations defense. And there was a long pause, and this fellow said, you know that fraud vitiates the statute of limitations. So that's why they settled.
I see. Sure, okay.
Because they didn't want all of dirty linen brought out again, which would have traipsed them through the newspapers for a long time. And undoubtedly it was true. They were filing tax returns, which didn't really bear up, but the state had no power or no money to hire people to go and check this out. And, of course, that's what the new Constitution did. It brought in a state with a little bit more muscle to go bring people to heel when they were not treating the state fairly. In my view, that's gone a little bit too far.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But now there's the point where you practically can't do anything. But so there are two sides to that question. But the state was definitely at a disadvantage because it had this huge money power. And I think that's the main thing. It isn't the corruption necessarily of the Anaconda Company as an entity. It was just the huge size in relation to the state government.
Sure, yeah. And then, too, I think William A. Clark, one of the original Coffee Barons, was the president of the Constitutional Convention that resulted in the 1889 Constitution.
Yeah.
So obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, but probably the Constitution wasn't hostile to mining interests.
It had some very favorable provisions in there with respect to that. And the net proceeds of mines tax was one of them.
Yeah.
And of course, it almost required the state to do an audit of every return on net proceeds of mines, and then they played cat and mouse with the guys that were trying to do it, and it gave rise to a lot of bad situations. They had, you know, people would go up and give the county treasurer a bottle of gin and Butte at Christmas time and not pay their taxes. And there was this huge bunch of...
In fact, county assessors by the 1972 Constitution became employees of the state rather than elected on the local
level.
That's
correct.
That's one of the
principal reasons for that.
Yeah.
But, and it was just, I think, just the sheer size that did it. Right now, we have the same thing. I've gotten so shell-shocked myself that we have the state agencies, or the government agencies, the federal government, like the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management in Montana, that I think inordinately wield power because they have such large tracts of land that they're responsible for, and they have so much power, and they pretty well do as they please. And I don't think that's necessarily a good economic good to the people.
Yeah, I'm sure. Ward, we've got time for just a couple more questions. And I'd like to have you maybe as a concluding question just mention anything perhaps that I didn't remember to ask, or anything any comment or observation that you'd like to make. But before then, you've been involved here in the legislative process during the administrations of numerous governors.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a governor or two, or an incident or two involving a governor that stands out in your mind? Or
I'm not sure I want to tell you about incidents, like Ted Schwinden a lot. I thought he was a straight shooter and told you what he thought, let the chips fall where they may pretty well. And of course, Tim Babcock has been a long time friend of mine. Of course, comes from my hometown. So that was
Glendive, Miles
City.
Yeah.
And I knew Hugo Aronson. Got a kick out of him.
Why?
Huh?
What about Hugo Aronson?
Well, he just had that kind of bluff country humor, you know, that kind of lighten things up. He, that famous statement of his that they always quote him on is, they'd say, well, Hugo, how many people work in Helena? And he'd say, about half of them. But I think, you know, and I've known just about all the rest of them up to the present time, but I think Ted Swindon probably sticks out of my mind as probably as good a governor as we had, although Mark Roscoe is right up there also with that.
What was there about Swindon and Roscoe that set them apart?
Well, they're just bright men with a lot of experience, and said what they thought, and thought out what they were going to say, and stuck with it. That's the main thing. Big problem in politics, as you know, is changing your mind and being seen as wishy-washy. That's the thing that you know, everybody gets on your back for. It's a continuing saga.
And I don't want to put you on the spot, and you might be reluctant to answer this, but do the best you can. Is there a governor that stands out in your mind, or governors that you would rate well below the two that you rated highly?
Yeah, I guess I would, but I really don't want to say about that.
Okay.
You know, and it all depends on your point of view, sure. Of course, too. There are some people that think the person walks on water, but to me, integrity is the most important thing. The guy that knows you're an adversary and tells you exactly what he thinks and tells you what he's going to do and then does it, that puts an aura of a reliability in the government, as far as I'm concerned. You know what the governor thinks, and you can go bounce something off of him to see how he reacts to it, because you know that you'll get a straight answer.
Sure. Anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
I've probably said too much already.
It's been great, but if you've got any final observations.
Well, I've got all kinds of anecdotes, but
give me one.
I'm going to write them down. My daughter sent me a book on how to write your memoirs, and so I got to get my garage cleaned out.
Well, good.
I'm going to try to do that.
Well, I look forward to reading it.
Because my short-term memory is starting to lapse, so I'm going to have to go back and pick up this paper and go back through it and see what the hell it really meant.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Bob. Thank you.